Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Tuesday, February 11th. I'm Ray Graff. It's birding time. Our favorite bird experts are back. Rich Guthrie and Julie Hart are here to share their knowledge with you, answer your questions about the birds. Give us a call if you have one. 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us, voxpop@wamc.org. VoxPop@WAMC.org or 800-348-2551. It's birds today. Rich Guthrie and Julie Hart and you right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's birds today, and our avian experts are back, Rich Guthrie and Julie Hart. Rich is retired from the New York State DEC and is now the regional reviewer for the premier birding site eBird. Julie Hart is project coordinator of the New York Breeding Bird Atlas. She coordinated thousands of volunteers to document bird breeding behaviors. She has a focus on bird conservation and citizen science. If you have a bird question, call. 800-348-2551 is our number. 1-800-348-2551. Tends to get pretty crowded on this show, so you might want to do it while there's a little room in the nest, so to speak. Or you can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. VoxPop@WAMC.org or 800-348-2551. Julie Hart, welcome back to Studio A.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
You know, believe it or not, Rich Guthrie is traveling. So he's on the phone. We didn't see him.
It's hard to believe.
I know. It's crazy. Rich, are you there?
I am here, Ray. Good afternoon. And hi, Julie.
Hi. You're in Florida?
Yes, I am. Sunny Florida.
Are you on a speakerphone?
I am not.
Oh, it sounds like you're talking through a cup and a wire, but that's all right. We'll make it work. It's okay, Rich.
Oh, my gosh. Really?
What?
I say, oh, my gosh. I'm sorry. Well, I'll try to locate.
Ah, splendid. Well, Julie, since you're here and you saw the picture, you know, Dina Salzman, who is a great artist, she did the bird socks for, you know, premium, and she does all our socks. She has, in honor of you guys being on today, made one of her finest works, and I believe it's a silver-belted beak stretcher. what is it?
A belted kingfisher.
A belted kingfisher.
Yes.
And it's blue.
It's blue, yes.
Where's the belt, though?
It's that rusty red band across the breast.
So this is a blue bird, and it has a rusty red band, and you said it's a mommy bird.
It's a female.
Really?
So the females actually are more colorful than the males. So the females are the ones with the rusty band, and the males do not have the rusty band.
Interesting.
That's how I knew immediately what that bird was.
Isn't she a great artist, though?
Yes.
She really is. Rich, I hear some, you got a steel drum band there where you are? I hear some strange tones.
That's probably a distant machine operating outdoors here. I'm sitting out on the patio. How's the audio now, Ray?
Oh,
how we doing?
Yeah, you're 5x5, good buddy. That's right.
Okay, we're in.
800-348-2551 if you have birding questions. All right, before we get to the phones, Rich, you're in Florida, right?
Yes, I am.
Yeah,
and so, for now, but not for long.
What birds are you seeing down there?
Oh, a lot of our familiar summer birds are here, and a lot of our unfamiliar birds are here, such as reddish egret and wood storks and spoonbills, as well as a lot of the local varieties, like the specialty jay that they have down here called the Florida scrub jay, the crested caracara, all sorts of neat things.
Crested caracara, I like that. All right, yeah. Julie Hart, what's new with you? What birds have you seen up here in the Northeast?
One thing I wanted to mention is that it is like starting to be a little bit love in the air. I know we're coming up on Valentine's Day, but you can start to, when you're outside, you'll start to hear some of the birds singing.
Yeah.
And so they are starting to get ready for this coming breeding season already. So our resident birds get started pretty early. So you'll be able to hear like woodpeckers and titmice and chickadees and cardinals. They're all starting to sing.
And they've been there all along.
They've been here all winter.
What are they? We've talked about this the other day at my house. What do they do when it's 10
really
below
cold.
and the weather's horrible? What do the birds do to stay warm?
They have a bunch of different adaptations. Actually, I think there was I just saw a book that just came out on winter bird adaptations that looked really interesting. One thing that they, like all birds do, is that they can move. They have these little muscles at the base of every single feather on their body.
No way.
And so that's how they can fluff themselves up. And so basically it's like fluffing up a pillow, and they're fluffing up the down feathers on their body, and that gives them more insulation.
So they have a little muscle at the,
yes.
at the what are
like
they called? Follicle?
Like how we get goosebumps.
Yeah.
But they can control them.
Amazing.
And then fluffs out their feathers, and that creates more insulation for them. So that's one thing.
Yeah.
But a lot of birds that we have here all winter, they will sleep in a cavity. And sometimes they'll all crowd in together, and then they can keep each other warm that
yeah.
way, too. But getting out of the wind, getting out of the rain or snow, that's really critical for them.
It's Birds Today. Rich Guthrie is in Florida, and he's on the phone out on the deck having himself a lovely time. Julie and I are here in the Northeast, and it's all right. We're having fun so far.
Yeah.
All right, let's go to the email, and then we'll take a break, and then we'll hit the phones, 800-348-2551. Okay, Rich, since you don't see our visual cues, I'll throw this question to you, all right? Here we go. This is from Eliza, or is it Eliza? I don't know. I'll just say Alyssa. Good afternoon. I've noticed that there are no robins in my yard anymore. For 20-plus years, they've been here year-round. I do and always have fed them. What do you think, Rich?
Well, they're around somewhere, but not in your yard, obviously. And what they do is they meander. A few of them stay around for the winter. Most of them migrate away. They're down here now. A few of them do stick around. And those that do are looking for sheltered areas where they can find a adequate supply, reliable supply of food. Berries primarily through the winter. And so they're somewhere not far, and soon they'll be right back. So I don't know what the situation in the yard is this year that makes it different than other years, but not to worry. The robins are doing good, and I think that you're just a matter of a few moments to a few days they'll be back. And one thing to add on to what Julie was saying, there is an adaptation that one of my favorites about winter bird survival in this climate is that some of the birds actually tunnel into the snow and make themselves a little igloo underneath a snowdrift where they create a cavity that keeps themselves tight, toasty warm until the morning. And it becomes a little bit of a challenge if there is a added snowfall during the night, or worse yet, an ice storm during the night that glazes over the entrance. But they've come through that, and some of the field birds, like hornlarks and snow buntings and longspurs, will also tuck tufts of grass and find themselves a little overhang of grass tufts and sit out the winter, out of the wind and weather. So one of the magnificent survival techniques that Julie was mentioning that's out there.
All right, this email from Deb, I'll throw this one to you, Julie. Raptors in the median is the subject heading. Deb writes, I travel from the Berkshires to East Greenbush at least once a week. While on I-90, I've noticed several times that there will be hawks standing in the grass or snow on the median, generally at least three spread along a mile or so stretch. Just wondering what they might be doing. It seems that if they were hunting, they'd have better vantage point from the trees along the highway. So glad you're on today, because this has been puzzling me. That's from Deb.
They are indeed hunting. It's much easier for them to see the prey where it's more open habitat. And usually those medians are mowed, and so it's pretty open. You'll notice a lot of times that the hawks are perched in the top of a tree right along the road.
Mm-hmm.
When you're seeing them on the ground, that means they probably saw prey there and tried to grab the prey, or they're actually eating the prey at that time.
Uh-huh.
So that's what they're doing when they're on the ground. When they're up in the tree is when they're on the lookout, so to speak, and searching for prey. And so their prey, you know, is small rodents that are in and out of the snow.
All right, this is from Mariana in Lackawaxen, Pennsylvania. And Rich, I'll start with you, and then we'll go over to Julie, then we'll take a break, then we'll hit the phones. 800-348-2551 is our number, 800-348-2551. Mariana writes, I've had blue jays eating what appears to be paint chips off an old iron railing. There are not any insects on the rail. I've noticed this several times over the past few years, only in the winter. Any idea why they would do that, Rich?
That's baffling. I'll have to take a wild guess at that. I'll call it scientific, but don't count on that. They're probably looking to get the hard, sharp edges of the chips of paint to act as grit for digesting winter food. Birds require some sort of hard surface in their gullet in order to break up the seeds and mush things up a little bit. So I don't know that that's very good for them, but I will say that there's a solution to that. If you put some grit out there for them, they'll much appreciate that. You'll see some birds on the roadsides picking up sand and salt that they're looking for as grit. If nowhere else, you can find suitable material at a pet supply store, because household or kept birds also require grit, and the pet supply stores provide a suitable indoor material. So try that.
Okay.
Other than that, I can't imagine there's certainly nothing nutritional or tasty in a paint chip.
Well,
no way.
Julie Hart, before we take a break here, what do you think?
I think that sounds as good a reason as any. I also am a bit puzzled if there are no insects in there and if they haven't hidden any seeds in there earlier in the season that they're trying to get out.
Yeah.
I know I have a lot of blue jays in my yard, and they're constantly trying to hide them in the railing on the porch.
Oh,
all the time. Like any little nook or cranny, they'll be shoving stuff in there to try to save it for later in the winter when it's cold.
So
another adaptation that some of our birds have.
Fascinating. So. All right, let's take a break here. It's Birding Today. Julie Hart and Rich Guthrie, and you will hit the phones in a moment. 800-348-2551. Just like me, they long to be close to you here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the number. Ray Graff over here. Julie Hart is across the table here. Rich Guthrie is across the country, down in warm weather, and he's not going to rub it in. Let's go to the phones. We'll start out in Averill Park. Gene, you're on.
Hi, I'm just wondering, I'm seeing less wild bird activity at the bird feeder this winter, and I'm just wondering if the bird flu has taken its toll on wild birds as well as farm animals.
All right, Julie, we were talking about bird flu in the beginning of, before we started,
before the show.
So go ahead.
Yeah. I have not heard that people have been seeing less birds at their feeders, and in terms of the bird flu, it can actually affect some songbirds, but for the most part, it's restricted to waterfowl. So ducks and geese and raptors are much more commonly affected
in
by the bird flu in the wild.
Obviously chickens, egg-bearing
right.
chickens, not so
yes.
much the meat-bearing chickens, which is strange.
Yes. I don't know why that is.
I guess they're kept separately. I think that might be part of it.
Yeah, so I haven't heard anything about there being less birds at the feeders this year.
Okay. Yeah. Rich, you want to add anything?
I do, actually. This coming weekend, the weekend of Thursday through Monday, February 14th through 17th, is the annual Great Backyard Bird Count. Now, there's where we can put some numbers to the monitoring of backyard birds and feeder birds. That's coming weekend, 14th through 17th. And you can learn about it online by going to Great Backyard Bird Count 2025. And there's a learning event and a Zoom meeting tomorrow, Wednesday at 3 p.m. Look at that Great Backyard Bird Count website. Google that, and you'll see the details of registering for tomorrow's learning event about this event that's coming up on this 4-day weekend. So go for it and put some numbers in there so we have some way of monitoring what's going on.
Julie.
Yeah, thanks, Rich, for adding that in there. I do want to just say one other thing about the bird flu, though, just because I know a lot of people have this question. A lot of people have been asking if they should take their feeders down. And the recommendation right now is that we don't need to be concerned about it, partly because the songbirds are not being as affected by the disease. However, if you have chickens on your own or geese, then you want to take your bird feeders down. But otherwise, most of us can keep them up.
Gene, thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551 is our number. It's Birds Today with Julie Hart and Rich Guthrie. And let's see, we'll go to Schenectady. It's Joan. Hello, Joan.
Hello, Ray. I apologize. I may be on speakerphone.
You're all right.
Okay, good.
Sure.
Thank you. Did they warn you? This is a gruesome tale of the perils of leucism.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Well, I don't know. We'll find out.
I got a chuckle there, so I know somebody's on to the plot line. It was about a month ago. I saw the most beautiful pigeon among the little grouping of rock doves. She was, he or she, white tail, white belly, mostly white head and wings. Beautiful.
Okay.
And as I admired her and pummeled my brain to come back with, what's that word? What's that word that they taught me? I remembered leucism.
Okay.
Later that afternoon, looking out the window, I saw the most beautiful hawk. Pretty sure it was a Cooper hawk, large, mostly silver gray. Anyway, I noticed the feathers on the ground where the hawk was eating were very white.
Yeah.
And it's true. The bird caught that one beautiful white rock dove.
Okay. Joan, what are you doing, and why do you have a duck call? What's going on?
It sounded like a door hinge.
What's going on over there?
Why do I have a wolf?
What are you doing over there? We're hearing strange creaks, and what's happening, Joan?
Oh, I was just coming back in the house to approach my radio because I sensed that you were about to say goodbye, so I wanted to get back near my radio.
My God, I'm going to call you Nostradamus because that's exactly what I'm about to do. No, that's interesting. Julie, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I'll just comment. For people that aren't familiar with that term, leucism, that just means that the birds are missing some of the melanin in their feathers, so they have white blotches or patches, or they may be even almost all white.
Yeah.
And when they're like that, then yes, they don't have as good of camouflage, and they are much
easier
more visible,
prey.
So they're easier prey. Yeah. So yes. that all makes sense.
Well, Joan, thank you very much. Appreciate the call. Have a good one. 800-348-2551. It's Birds Today. Rich Guthrie and Julie Hart. Rich, do you have any comment on leucism?
No, I do not. I think Julie hit the nail right on the head.
Okay. Let's go to Hyde Park then, and it's John's turn. Hello, John.
Hey, Ray. It's me, John Fisher.
Oh, my gosh. John Fisher, now that you're retired, you're listening to this program, you poor sap. What do you got going on?
I actually even listened before.
Really?
We have a pair of big woodpeckers that have adopted us. And for most of my entire life, I've called them pileated, that I looked it up, and apparently it's pronounced pileated. I just want to know what it's really,
oh, God,
the way the name is. Really,
thanks for opening that. All right, let's start with Rich. Go ahead, Rich.
Well, it's potato, potato, tomato, tomato, pileated, pileated. Take your pick. Either is good. Both are good.
Okay, and then Julie, what would you prefer?
I personally use pileated, but okay. I think I'm in the minority. Yeah, that,
what do you use, Rich?
No, I'm pileated is for me, but pileated is for some.
Yeah, I'm sorry, you're both
either
wrong. It is pileated.
both are correct.
I give up.
All right, fine. John, do you have anything of value to add to the program?
Absolutely nothing.
All right, sir. Well, I'm going to dispatch you then, and we'll talk to you soon. 800-348-2551. Our friend John Fisher just retired from the Culinary Institute. He was up. So here's a little inside baseball. The fun drive was so fast last week that I had no show planned for Friday. And I called John midweek. I said, John, what are we going to do? He came up. We did a show about the history of cocktails. It was very nice. He's a mixologist par excellence. He's
nice.
Quite a talented fellow. Obviously not too knowledgeable about birds, but he gave it a shot. Dassey in Sandusfield, you're on.
Hi, I'm calling about the reason that blue jays peck at the paint.
Oh.
They pecked at the side of my house, and I consulted the Audubon Society. They're looking for calcium, and apparently most paints are made with some calcium. The only paint that isn't is, what's the most popular brand of paint?
There's oil-based paint, there's...
No, I don't mean that. I mean the brand.
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I mean, no.
Well, I could tell you, because I then had to call around and find out what each brand puts in their paint. But apparently, Benjamin Moore does not put any calcium in their house paint. And so I had to repaint that side of my house.
Did it work?
Huh. Well, it worked somewhat, but apparently blue jays are very smart and they've taught their young. So each year it's less and less, but they still do it.
Interesting. Julie, what do you make of that?
It is very interesting. I did not know that, but it does make sense. There are calcium is one of those minerals that is harder for a lot of birds to come by. So I had no idea that it was added to a lot of paints.
Rich, what do you think?
Well, try this. Instead of paint, crush up some eggshells and scatter them out and about and make them available. And that'd be a natural source of calcium for the birds.
Huh. Okay.
Yeah, it's only when there's enough snow in the ground that they can't get their calcium by pecking around on the ground. So some years are better than others.
Interesting.
There you go.
Fascinating.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for the call. 800-348-2551. Birds today, Julie Hart at Rich Guthrie. And let's see. Let's do an email and then we'll go back. This is from James, who says, quick question. Where do turkeys go in the winter? Or should I say, how do they survive the winter when it gets down below zero? Rich.
Well, turkeys actually can go into a torpor state and sit out the bad weather. And I don't want to call it hibernation because a few birds do, and I'm not sure turkeys are among them. But they can go into a sleep mode and sit out bad weather. And that can go on for a few days, from what I understand.
Wow.
Rich, do you know, so I'm thinking of like a lot of the grouse. They are one of those species that does burrow into the snow to stay warm. Are turkeys, they usually roost in the trees in the summer. Where are they when they're in the torpor state? Are they down in the snow? Do you know?
No, I don't think they go into the snow. I believe they still... hang out in the trees because, otherwise they're kind of an easy prey for ground predators during the dark hours.
All right.
So do we know the mechanism they use to go into this, would you say, torpor state? And can humans do that? Can we learn how to do that?
I do that quite often, unintentionally.
After lunch, after Thanksgiving meal.
Yes.
All right. Well, let's see.
In general, humans cannot. The one bird that Rich alluded to that does go into hibernation is the poor will down in the Southwest, American Southwest.
No, it's never like cold the down one. There. Why do they do that?
I assume
it does get cold
that
in the desert.
It does get cold.
It goes below freezing.
It does, and I assume that then there's much less insects around for them to eat.
Oh, that makes sense.
Because they do eat insects.
So how do they? Okay, so all right, let's go along that tack for a minute. So they go into hibernation because maybe there aren't enough insects. What do they? How do they survive? How do they not eat and live?
Their whole metabolism slows down, right? Like their heart rate slows down, their body temperature cools off, they're not breathing as fast, you know, like, so they're kind of, it's like a mini hibernation.
I wonder if there was ever a time in evolution when mammals could do that. I mean, humans, I know bears do it, but I mean, why can't we do it? I want to do that. Take the winter off. All right,
is
this
like
is
cryo freezing.
Yes.
Kind of what this
yes,
is.
Yes, that's what I want to do. Okay. Suspended animation.
Well, you can all right. You could migrate south to Florida and try that.
Yeah, well, don't rub it in there, smart guy. Chris in Boston Spa writes, does bird flu affect yard birds? Well, we talked about that.
Yes, we did.
And it's everything seems okay at this time, right?
Right.
All right, one more email, and then we'll go back to the phones. This is from, well, this is a comment from Rowan and Wendell. Just wanted to point out to you all our favorite birding calendar, 2 years running. Extremely Accurate Birds by Tommy Siegel. Do you know that bird calendar?
No.
Okay. What about you, Rich?
No, I do not know it, and it's something worthwhile to check out. Thank you.
Okay, thanks a lot, Rowan, and if that is your name and it's not Tommy Siegel. All right, let's go to Eric in Canaan. Eric, you're on.
Hi. Earlier in the winter, the end of the fall, there was a heron that moved onto our property and was spending most of the day on a field near our house. It was really cool. We got to take pictures of it, and it was, like, totally fearless. I'd be walking, you know, behind a barn and look to my left, and there'd be the heron, I don't know, 20 feet from me, just kind of staring at me.
Okay.
And it stuck around for maybe 2 or 3 weeks, and then didn't see it as much, and I'm just curious what it maybe was doing and if there's any chance it might come back again. We don't have a ton of water near us, there's a small creek that is maybe a half a mile away and a very small stream another, you know, eighth of a mile downhill, so it's not like there's a big body of water that it was feeding from.
They do eat small mammals, too.
Say it again, Julie, and then we'll throw it over to Rich.
They do eat small mammals as well. So they'll eat, like, frogs, fish, small mammals.
Well, we have mountains and mountains of mice here.
Okay, so that could be what they were just feasting on, that would be my idea.
Mm-hmm.
Rich?
Yeah, I'm in on that. They do forage in open fields and take what they can get. But I also want to check and make sure that you're not discounting the possibility of crane, the sandhill crane, which is actually an upland bird. It resembles a heron very, very much. And they tend to be a lot more tolerable than herons. So checked out?
I've seen sandhills before, and it was definitely a heron. And that's why it was so surprising and that it was so fearless.
Interesting.
I know sandhills will really kind of get into the neighborhood.
Okay.
Yeah, I share that then. Well, yes, and as Julie says, they do forage in fields for small mammals and whatever else they can get. I wouldn't be surprised if they pick up some corn, leftover corn, and other field crops that may be out there. But their main goal is the mice and voles.
Yeah.
All right. Eric, thanks a lot for the call. And by the way, we just found out, I got to say, the extremely accurate birds are really not. And, you know, I think Tommy Siegel might have a few issues. I think he might be a booty call. I'm just saying.
Yeah. 800-348-2551.
Yeah, kids, don't look at that one. Although it's interesting art, but it's a little demented. Let's take a break. 800-348-2551. Thanks, Rowan. You're now banned from emailing the program. Goodbye. John Schofield, Can't Get No Satisfaction on WAMC. 800-348-2551 is the number. All right, quick one for you, Julie, and then we'll go back to the phones. Andre writes, Andre in Croton on Hudson, is it good or bad to put bread in a suet once in a while instead of the real stuff? I did it, and they love it.
Yeah, oh, well, it depends, I would say. In general, I usually say don't put human food out there. But if there's not too many preservatives and additives, then it may be okay.
Okay. Rich, do you agree?
Oh my God. Type breads, the more nutritious style breads or raisin bread would be a real delight. Mm-hmm. Other than that, yeah, sure. I'm with Julie.
Okay, fair enough. Let's go back to the phones. It's Birding Today with Rich Guthrie and Julie Hart. We'll go to Kinderhook, and it's Rudy. Hello, Rudy.
Hi, I have a question about bluebirds. We have a couple paired nesting boxes on either side of our house, and I know they tend to congregate in the nesting boxes when it's really cold. And the other day we noticed a bunch had come out in a slightly mild day in January. And we also have, given to us by our daughter, one of those feeder with a camera on it. So we went and got some mealyworms, and put them in that feeder with the camera. We saw a bluebird sitting on our mudroom eyeing us putting it in, but it didn't come down. And I'm wondering if they are more prone to bird flu since they nest in these high concentrations in a nesting box in winter.
I don't think so, only because I actually, before I came on the show, tried to do a little research, and I looked at on the USDA website of the list of bird species that have been have detections of bird flu in
yeah.
them.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave some numbers, some quantities, and bluebirds and like house finches, birds that tend to come in big groups were not very commonly affected by
mm-hmm.
bird flu.
Okay. Rich.
No, I defer to Julie on that. I think that's in the USDA Wildlife Service. So I would not be concerned, but monitor and report.
Okay.
We'll just keep putting mealyworms in.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, cardinals and everything kick them out. They probably kick them all out before the bluebirds come, but whatever.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe you can move the mealworm feeder farther from the other food that you have out.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
That's a good idea.
All right, Rudy, thanks a lot. 800-348-2551. It's Birds Today. It's Trish's turn. Trish is in Schenectady. Hello, Trish. You're on.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Sure. Go ahead. Although I hear somebody else as well.
That was, the radio. All right, you can hear me. So I have been feeding the birds for 8 years now, and the cardinals, I've watched families and woodpeckers families and goldfinch families, like really been doing great. But then all of a sudden, about a year ago, all these pigeons came because I live near downtown Schenectady. I'm in the stockade. I have a lot of woods around my house, but I'm in the stockade. And all these pigeons came, and then all of a sudden this winter, all of these hawks came. And the hawks are going after the pigeons right and left, and it's very sad, but hawks have to live too, and And I'm like, well, I'm feeding all the birds. But I worry about the cardinals and my chickadees, my titmice. The goldfinch don't seem to be fazed at all by them. They just flock. I've had so many goldfinch this winter. But I'm really concerned. When the hawks come, I go out and scare them away, but I'm not always there. Should I take the feeders down for a few days? Or is that just nature and I leave the feeders up because otherwise the birds won't have seed?
Interesting. Julie.
Yeah, I that all tracks with what I see at feeders as well. That it tends to be the way, like the circle of life, right? That the hawks are going to come in and they're going to go for the pigeons and the mourning doves. They tend to prefer those.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of unavoidable.
Rich?
Yeah, that's true. And you're providing a feeding station for everybody. You know, a lot of people are not happy with that, but it is, thank goodness, well, I don't know about the pigeon part, how they feel about it, but good thing they're available.
Probably not that good, I'm guessing.
I'm
not opposed to the pigeon, because honestly, the pigeons are really messy and I really don't like them. They're beautiful. They have every right to be here just as much as the other birds do, but the reason I feed is for the songbirds. So I'm not really terribly sad. I just don't want to endanger my cardinals by, you know, leaving the feeders up. Like, you know, if I see hawks around.
Yeah, the cardinals and some of the other songbirds are much more agile and faster. And so unless they're very sick or old or injured, they're probably going to escape much easier than a pigeon. So most likely the pigeons are what's going to get taken. But the other thing that you can try is changing the food that you're putting out. I don't know what you're putting out, but, you know, the pigeons are not as drawn to some kinds of food as others. And so you can experiment.
I've been told they don't like safflower, but that's been disproven.
Yep.
And I do. And the other thing I've been doing is I've been putting a little birdhouse feeder. It's a feeder that's shaped like a birdhouse in the bushes, so that because cardinals like to feed on the ground. So I've been tucking it away in there. But I have some really nice squirrel-proof, you know, feeders that hang. And the hawks just come right down from the oak tree over at the Dutch Reformed Church and swoop down. I have yet to see anybody but pigeons. And I mean, bless their hearts, they deserve to be here. But the hawks have to eat something. I'm glad.
Yeah. Well, they must be delicious.
People are probably hating me for saying this, but you know, that's how I feel.
All right, Trish. Well, thanks. We're gonna let you go there. Go ahead.
Switching up food is something that I do a lot, and I found that particularly having just an incredible amount of goldfinch. I had a lot of babies last year of a lot of kinds of birds, but an incredible amount of goldfinch.
Incredible.
And I've never seen so many in a winter as this year, so I'll go on that bird count and contribute.
Cool. Well, thank you very much for the call.
We've also had higher number of goldfinches this year than we have the last. So we've been here now 6 years.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know.
It's been so cold.
Maybe. Yeah. I don't know what it is this year.
Interesting.
I haven't been able to put my finger on it.
All right, let's go to Dalton, Massachusetts. Skyler, you're on.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just calling to comment on feeding crows and receiving gifts.
Okay.
I have two crows that I've been feeding for the last few weeks. When I let the dogs out in the morning, they're always waiting. There's two of them. After a couple weeks, they left a big piece of bread, like a big giant dinner roll, right in the peak of my garage, and it sat there for days and days. And I was wondering if that was a gift from the crows, or is that just they just left it there? I don't know.
Rich, do you?
Rich,
I didn't get the what it was.
He left
it behind, but
a dinner roll.
Oh, dinner roll, yeah.
Yeah, on the top of the house.
Yeah, because I was throwing cashews up on the garage, and then they left this big piece of bread, and then they didn't eat it or anything. They just left it perched right on the peak.
Oh, that's very nice.
I was wondering
of them.
If that was a gift.
What do you think, Rich?
Well, it's either that or a hint. Maybe they're saying, you know, how about a little bread with our meal here?
Well, what would your best guess be, Rich? Do you think this, in fact, is a gift from the crows?
If it were from the crows, I would be very, very surprised because they're not apt to be giving up good stuff. They'll give you good junk, but not good food. And bread, even dinner rolls are good chow for any crow. So
okay.
I'm thinking that maybe it came from someone else, and I'm surprised the crows even left it, let it stay there. But yes, crows are good at giving gifts if you can get them to like you that much.
Really? Okay. Well, thank you very much, Skylar. Appreciate the call. Julie, has a crow ever left you a gift?
No, but you know, I've never tried feeding crows either. So that's why I leave all the crow questions to Rich.
I love crows. We were out back taking the air, and they were going nuts. And my wife said, oh, there's a big bird, like in the middle of, they were, I guess what, shepherding
mobbing.
This thing away from the nest?
Mobbing.
So cool. Yeah. All right, let's see. Why don't we go to Alex in Great Barrington? Hello, Alex, you're on. Hello, Alex, you're on. Yo, Alex.
I was wondering about Carolina wrens. I've had them down in Long Island for a few years now, but up here in Great Barrington, this is the first year I've had a pair. And they seem to always feed just right off the ground, you know, in the grass and that sort of thing. But somewhere around Thanksgiving, they learned, go up onto the bird feeder and have even more recently been even sticking their heads into the actual holes to get seed. Is that normal behavior, or is that something I know they're sort of working their way north as global warming is happening and,
okay.
Is this particularly out of range for them, and is using a bird feeder abnormal?
Gotcha. Can you listen on the radio, Alex? Your connection's pretty bad.
Okay, very good. Okay. Will do.
All right, Julie first, then Rich.
Yeah, so that is pretty normal. I have Carolina wrens at my feeders all the time. They don't like to come in when there's like a lot of bigger birds around, but they will come in and they'll eat out of the feeder. So that's normal. As you mentioned, they are one of the species that is moving north with climate change, but also that tracks pretty well with a lot of more people having feeders out as well. That provides them with a stable food source throughout the winter. So Great Barrington is a bit higher than here. So I actually don't know. I'm not that familiar with how frequently Carolina wrens winter there, but around here it's very normal.
Rich.
Yeah, they've been the Carolina wren is a really interesting case study in winter survival adaptations, and yes, they have been inching their way northward and upward through the last few decades. Mm-hmm. It's really an interesting study. And that they come to feeders is not a surprise to me either. And you can put some, if they do like mealworms, if they could only learn that they're there. And also, I found that they're very tame. They're very trusting. I've had them come right up to my hand and take a little bit peanut chips out of my hand and hop away with it and either tuck it away or chow it down and come right back again. Both of them. Yeah.
Amazing.
So good luck with that. I love those little guys. They still sing in the spring when the spring is in the south. So they still have their old time clock with them. And so any day now, they'll start chirping up their spring song, January. And you got to love it. February, they're right on time.
All right. This email from Nancy. All right, Julie, I'll throw this to you initially here. I have seen two red-winged blackbirds at my feeders in Orange County, New York, a spotted small flock of about 10 in a tree about a quarter mile down the road. It appears red wings have returned to central Orange County, says Nancy.
Interesting. I saw a small flock of probably like 7 birds on my drive into the studio today.
Really?
And I haven't seen them for, I don't know, a couple months.
And they have red wings under or on top?
They're on the shoulders.
Okay.
Yeah.
Big birds or little birds?
Little birds.
Okay.
Yeah.
Would they be around town?
Smaller than a robin. Yeah, they're around towns. Yeah, I mean, there's always a few scragglers that hang out and show up in the middle of winter. But maybe we are on the front edge, I don't know,
okay,
of migration. I'm not sure.
Rich, you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, sure. The red-winged blackbird is really the true harbinger of spring nowadays. It used to be the robin, but they've kind of given up that role by just hanging around too long through the winter. But the red-winged blackbird are one of the very first ones to show up and start singing from that cattail marsh down below. So, yeah, that's a sure sign down there in Orange County that they'll show up there first and work their way up the valley, up the Connecticut Valley, right on up in February, right on time. Good job.
All right. Joel in East Bern writes, you folks may find this interesting. I first noticed a big hawk sitting on the peak of our barn a couple years ago. I was surprised that it didn't scare away too easily. I found out what it was up to soon enough. It suddenly dive-bombed one of those annoying molehills in our backyard and flew away with a mole. That's
nice.
Cool.
Nice.
You know what? Send them over to my yard. Let's go to Porter's Corners. Joe, you're on.
Yes, hello. Joe Brewshacker, old friend of the show. And
hey.
I wanted to compliment you guys on what you've been doing. And I have a question relating to the naming of birds.
Okay. Oh, can you turn your radio down, buddy?
One.
Can you turn
sure
that?
Thing.
Yeah, just a little bit. Okay.
How's that?
Good. Go ahead.
Naming of birds. Two things. One, why would a red-bellied woodpecker be named a red-bellied woodpecker when it is a red head? And secondly, what's happening with the idea about renaming some of the birds that are named after people,
uh-huh,
like Cooper's Hawk or Swainson's and so on?
Gotcha. All right. Rich, you first.
Yeah, the red-bellied woodpecker, well, first of all, red-headed woodpecker name was already taken. You know, there was no vacancy there, so they had to go with some of. And back in the day, they used to name birds on the table, you know, belly up on the table. And red-bellied woodpeckers do have a red belly, for sure.
Okay.
But the problem is you really can't see it unless it's upside down or unless you're underneath it.
Right.
So, yeah, it's a bit of a misnomer. I kind of like zebra-back woodpecker or something like that, but that's kind of a little esoteric or exotic for our local bird. And as far as the naming is concerned, well, that's a very controversial issue out there.
Mm-hmm.
I prefer naming birds for either their plumage, what they look like, where their mm-hmm. habits, or even their location, if that is appropriate. But
right.
yeah, mm-hmm. but there's a lot of history behind the naming of birds, and some of it wants to be having a second look at and
all
seeing
right.
about the appropriateness of some of those names.
Rich, we only have about a minute here, so I want to let Julie chime in here. I know we've talked about this naming of birds in the past.
Yeah, and I totally agree with what Rich said. There is a special committee that has been convened with the American Ornithological Association that is looking into this issue
okay.
and trying to get feedback from as many people as possible and thinking about how
well,
to
thank you guys so very much. You know, the chickadee is an Abenaki word, chickadee, so that's an interesting name that
yeah.
comes out of what the bird says.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Hey, Joe, we got to leave it there. We're just about out of time, but thank you very much. All right, Julie Hart, you what do you got going on? Anything?
Not really.
No?
The
birding atlas
collecting
is
data for the atlas is over.
Are you,
right?
Are you,
so I'm still very busy working with the data and putting together a book to publish the results. But in terms of
will this
of
book
the,
be available?
Yes, it'll be available for purchase.
Where would you find it?
It'll be available online and probably at some book
oh,
sales
cool.
and
right.
things like this. So,
this are you writing this book?
I'm working with a whole
exciting.
Team of people to write a book. Yes,
oh,
so
that's
it's,
awesome.
It's going to be a multi-year project. So that's what I'm working on right now.
Outstanding.
So, yeah.
Rich Guthrie, what do you got going on? You have 12 seconds.
I'm on the road again, and next time I'm heading west out of the Panhandle to Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, Texas, and then from there, I'm either going to turn left or right and head back home sooner or later.
Now, you do know we have a show every month. I mean, you're going to make it back to the studio one of these days.
I'm looking forward to it. Ray, I miss you terribly.
Okay. Well, Rich, thanks a lot for being with us. Julie Hart, thank you for being here. Support comes from the Hyde Collection in Glens Falls. Sculpture, paintings, and mixed media by contemporary artists on view through March 30th. Cusp, open Thursday through Sunday, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Learn more at HydeCollection.org. Capital Roots, working to provide healthy food access with dignity for all Capital Region residents while supporting area farms and businesses. Grow, educate, provide, CapitalRoots.org. At Plaza Travel Center, small group trips from Albany to Iceland, Vietnam, Scotland, and more. For trip details, Gene@PlazaTravel.net. Well, that's it for today. Thank you, my bird-loving friends, for all the wonderful calls and emails. Sorry if we didn't get to yours. We'll do it again next month. Thanks to Rich Guthrie and Julie Hart. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Ed Rosen screened the calls. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, if you have intellectual property, tune in. It's the Copyright Forum. We'll see you tomorrow at 2.